Well, good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear me in the back? Great. I'm Ann Penny. I'm the Carl A. Kroc University Librarian, and this is a wonderful day for us. I want to thank you all for coming. 100 years ago, Samuel Clemens was the most famous man in the world. And he would probably be pleased to know that fame endures. Mark Twain's best known and most beloved books have never gone out of print and exist in hundreds of editions and translations. Millions of American school children are still assigned his books every year, and I understand that in 3 English classes this past fall at Cornell, one of his books was on the reading list. Not only is Mark Twain still famous, he's still controversial. Huckleberry Finn consistently shows up on the American Library Association's list of frequently challenged books. I would guess that he would be pleased to still be stirring up trouble. This exhibition acknowledges his fame as an author, certainly, but also we're taking a different tack, a more personal one. A century after his death, marked earlier this week, it's time to reassess Mark Twain's legacy, both as a writer and as an American icon. Samuel Clemens managed the business of being Mark Twain, an image he deliberately and purposefully invented for himself during a time in American history when new opportunities meant that men could go from poverty to riches overnight, when fame and wealth and success must have seemed perpetually just around the corner. He even coined the term we all use for that era, the Gilded Age. Samuel Clemens deeply loved the idea of the self-made man, making his own way in the world, building his future on the force of his own ideas, inventiveness, and creativity. And for lack of a better term, he worked it. He capitalized on his fame eagerly. In modern terms, we would say he developed his own brand. Branching out far beyond writing, he became an inventor, an entrepreneur, a publisher, even a creator of board games. And he fantasized about making millions. Samuel Clemens essentially invented and sold Mark Twain. Our new exhibition, titled Known by Everyone, Liked by All, explores Samuel Clemens' relationship with business, and more deeply, his relationship with himself as a brand, as a commodity that could be trademarked and sold. He was the first American to try to trademark his pen name, taking his case to court to protect his royalties abroad, but losing the first round. 30 years later, in 1908, he did manage to trademark the Mark Twain Company so that his heirs could collect book royalties even after his bankruptcy. The exhibition features an amazing range of Twain's written work, including first editions of nearly all of his books and stories, original handwritten letters, and the very last manuscripts written just days before his death. But it also focuses on the management of his own brand, using artifacts like games and cigars that help explain how he and others tried to capitalize on his fame. Someone very familiar to Cornellians may deserve some credit for setting Samuel Clemens on that path, Henry Sage. Sage, as you know, was one of Cornell's most prominent benefactors in its early years, serving as president of the Board of Trustees. He was also a former business partner of Clemens' father-in-law. In his autobiography, Mark Twain writes that Sage told him, quote, "Mr. Clemens, you've got as clear a business head on your shoulders as I have come in contact with for years. What are you doing being an author? You ought to be a businessman." This exhibit documents both sides of that Twain coin. The exhibition would never have been possible without the generosity of our friend Susan Jaffe-Tain, whose collection of Mark Twain's rare books, letters, photographs, and artifacts formed the nucleus of this exhibit, and who provided the funding for this event. Susan Tain's collection has been brought to life by Cornell librarian and exhibition curator Lance Heidick, whose enthusiasm and skillful research uncovered many of the stories that tie Mark Twain to Cornell, and who has woven the artifacts in Susan's collection into a fascinating narrative. Lance is also the editor of the printed catalog of Susan Tain's collection. Lance is deeply grateful to the generous community of Twain scholars who assisted him with his work, including today's speaker, Dr. Robert Hurst, and Mark Twain collector and scholar Kevin McDonald, who's in the audience. I'd also like to acknowledge and thank our friends and neighbors at the Center for Mark Twain Studies and the Mark Twain Archive in the Gannett Tripp Library at Elmira College, and the team of librarians, conservators, digital imaging specialists, web designers, and other library staff members who worked for the past year to make this celebration possible. And we would also like to acknowledge Irene Langdon, who is in the audience today. Irene married Samuel Clemens' great-nephew, Jervis Langdon Jr., who attended Cornell along with members of several generations of their family. I'm also here to introduce Peter Lepage. Peter was appointed the Harold Tanner Dean of College of Arts and Science in 2004. And during his tenure, undergraduate applications for admission to the college have risen more than 80%. Peter's work as dean emphasizes philanthropic support for academic priorities, including the establishment of several professorships and large departmental endowments. He is also a Cornellian, having spent his entire professional career here after joining the physics faculty in 1980. Please welcome Dean Lepage.
Thank you, Anne. By the time we go to see the exhibition later this afternoon, we'll have learned a great deal about Mark Twain. As Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, I'd like to present a slightly different set of observations. This celebration of Twain's life and work would not exist without two valuable allies in the presentation of culture: the library itself and a private collector. Great communities of scholars traditionally have been affiliated with great libraries. It's almost inconceivable that you could have a spectacular, highly ranked university without having an equally highly ranked library. While the material form of collections has changed over the centuries, you know, we now have DVDs, electronic data, as well as paper parchment and artifacts, the need for these resources remains and will remain forever. The library's various collections are critical to student learning, as well as faculty and graduate level research. Their importance cannot be overstated, especially for humanities scholars. The library is a humanist's lab, basically. Through exhibitions like this one, the library also has an impact on the Ithaca community. I see a lot of my fellow Ithacans here in the audience. Through exhibitions like this, and thanks to the internet, we have an impact not just on our local community, but on an international group of individuals of all circumstances and backgrounds. People are all eager to learn. The Mark Twain exhibition explores a writer whose brand, as Anne just remarked, is clearly still clearly understood across America. It would be impossible to illuminate his works and persona to this degree without the generosity of collector Susan Tain, who's sitting right here in the front, and who teamed up with our curatorial staff here. Thanks to them, our students, faculty, and our Ithaca community will have a more intense experience of Twain, both deeper and broader, than they would have had through traditional research carried out over time. Another contributor to the exhibition today is our speaker, Robert Hurst, who has spent more than four decades working directly with Mark Twain's writings. Since 1980, Robert has been general editor of the Mark Twain Project, a massive undertaking that includes two ongoing editions, the Mark Twain Papers and the Works of Mark Twain. Under Robert's leadership, more than 20 volumes have appeared, with many more underway. The steady flow of publications is understandable because when Twain died in 1910, he left behind the largest collection of personal papers written by any 19th century American author. That included more than 11,000 letters, just letters alone. In a second role, curator of papers for the Mark Twain Project, Robert Hertz has helped build the collection through gifts and purchases. He's uniquely positioned to oversee the growth of the collection, as well as the editing and publication of Twain's professional and personal writings, because Mark Twain has been at the center of his career from the start. While in graduate school at UC Berkeley, he supported himself as a proofreader and checker in the Mark Twain papers. After earning his doctorate in 1976 and joining the English faculty at UCLA, he continued to work on the papers at Berkeley, this time as a collaborator on several volumes of Mark Twain's early tales and sketches. Then he quickly moved into the general editor's role. Even after 44 years, Robert's inspired by his subject. In his own words, "If you're bored with Mark Twain, you either have no sense of humor or you haven't been paying attention." Hearst's new publication, Who is Mark Twain?, is a collection of 24 short pieces by Twain that have never appeared in book form. They range from a set of audacious speculations about Jane Austen's motivations as an author to happy memories of the dental chair. Sounds like Mark Twain. It's a pleasure to invite Robert Hearst to the podium. I can't imagine a better guide as we take a fresh look at one of America's most enduring and beloved literary figures. Please welcome Robert Hearst.
Thank you. Well, someone has stolen my text. You have it. I need it back. I'm not kidding.
A souvenir.
That's the first time that's ever happened to me. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
If you cannot hear me at any point, put your hand up and say, "Hey, Bob." Loud, like that. Thank you for those wonderful introductions. I've been introduced many times, and I'm always reminded of Mark Twain's favorite introduction, which took place out in California, where I work, a little town called Red Dog, where he was on a lecture tour. And of course, no one knew him. And so no one could introduce him. But they finally persuaded a miner, big hulking miner, to stand up and do the honors. And he said, "I don't know anything about this fellow. Or rather, I only know two things. One is, he's never been in the penitentiary. And the other is, I don't know why." Mark Twain said he liked that because it didn't raise expectations too high. It's a kind of funny title, isn't it? I'll have to confess that I created the title before I created the talk. I knew in general what I wanted to talk about, but I hadn't really gotten around to writing down the words. I sort of had the walrus and the carpenter in the back of my head. No offense, Susan. I actually take occasions like this to do something which I really can't do very often in my own job, which is to think about what I've been doing for 40 years. I mean, usually there's so much time spent doing it that you don't really know, you haven't really reflected upon what it is you're doing. So this is a kind of meditation on what I've been doing for 40 years. I hope it won't bore you too badly. The world has been collecting Mark Twain since long before he died, which, as we all now know, was almost exactly 100 years ago last Wednesday. "What ought to be done to the man who invented the celebrating of anniversaries," he said. "Mere killing would be too light." We know about these collectors really from two quite reliable sources. One, the actual begging letters he received over a long and busy lifetime, some 17,000 of which he saved, often with his own brief, highly readable annotations. These documents became part of the Mark Twain papers that he put into the hands of his official biographer, Albert Bigelow Payne, around 1906, 1907, and that, through a series of changes in location and curatorship, came to the University of California in 1949. They were given by his only surviving daughter, Clara Clemens Samusu. I thought you might like to see some of these annotations. Oh, not that way, you're not going to see him. I took 15 minutes, to go to the files. This is really from only a period of a few weeks. Mark Twain is unique, in my opinion, in that even when he doesn't answer a letter, he writes a little note on the envelope and keeps it. So you can see that this one, for instance, from some bore who wants to destroy the death penalty with an eye to his own future, doubtless. Down here, wants to be sent to the Munich Art School. Wants God knows what. Declined. In other words, I wrote a letter declining whatever it was. Bid for an autograph letter, quote, too thin. Meaning the request, which was to have him explain what he meant by higher than Gilderoy's kite, was too obvious and a ruse to get a letter signed by Mark Twain from some unknown idiot in Ireland. Well, I'm glad you guys can read it. I'm discovering that my students can't read cursive any longer because they're not taught cursive. From some unknown person who has probably brains and modesty in about equal proportions. This one down here, this is the worst piece of cheek of all. They asked him to name a club that they'd created. And this is from a Boston ass, as you can see, and then 2 days later, from the same Boston ass. I assure you we could multiply the examples almost infinitely. Many of these are actually ruses to get an autograph. Most often, actually, he responds by giving them the autograph. And usually a bit more interesting than these replies to his own notes are the replies that he did send out into the world, which, of course, are not part of the papers that he gave to Payne. And that survived quite literally only because the collectors saved them and passed them along to their heirs and assigns, who in at least a few cases sold or gave them to various public or private libraries. I have a few examples here. It's remarkable that such things survive at all, in my opinion, but this little sample may give you an idea of why. In almost all these cases, we do not even know the name of the person Mark Twain was writing to. That's how anonymous they are. Here's one he wrote in a reply to a request for money from the Massachusetts Infant Asylum, an orphanage for some 40 children. Dear madam, I beg to wish the best success in a long career of usefulness to the infant asylum, but words are empty, deeds are what show the earnest spirit. Therefore, I am willing to be one of 1,000 citizens who shall agree to contribute 2 or more of their children to this enterprise. Carefully signed down there, with a double signature. So he's giving them the autograph, but making a joke at their expense. Of course, he knew and they knew that they could sell this for $1,000, and that's what they did, and that's probably why we still have it. Here's another one. You have to listen to this one carefully. I didn't put it in the slides. I am a long time answering your letter, my dear Miss Harriet, but then you must remember that it is an equally long time since I received it. So that makes us even and nobody to blame on either side. And here's another one, which I've seen only described. It's probably owned by some collector who's unknown to me. In November 1882, the English writer William Ballantyne was so impatient for a reply to his request. Bad thing to be with Mark Twain, impatient. We don't know what the request was, but he was so impatient that he enclosed a piece of paper and a stamp with his original letter. Mark Twain answered, "Paper and stamp received. Please send envelope." And then there's this letter to Mr. Oldroyd, February 1874. This one took us a little while to figure out. Oldroyd at the time was employed as a guard, not an inmate, a guard, by the Dayton, Ohio Asylum for the Insane. And he almost certainly wrote his request on some official stationery, or at least with an envelope with that printed return address on it. Here's the reply he received. "Dear sir, certainly I will write you an autograph letter for your collection. And what is more, though please do not let the officers of the asylum know that I said such a thing, I believe that you are wickedly and unjustly confined there. That is, if they are rigorous with you, for portions of your letter to me are quite rational. And I'm satisfied that if you were put under mild and judicious treatment, you would get over it." Again, signed, beautiful signature, et cetera. If that seems a little obscure, your laughter shows me that it's not. Just picture Mr. Oldroyd rubbing his hands as he sees this letter in his mailbox and opens it and reads it, and only then decides that perhaps he'd better not show it to his friends. That is certainly what Mark Twain had in mind when he wrote this deeply subversive reply. One suspects that if he could have, he'd have made the document literally radioactive. At the risk of belaboring the obvious, let's just ask yourself why we are able to read these letters at all. The answer is just one word long: collectors. Of course, manuscript dealers, librarians, curators, and even editors may have played a part in their preservation. But it was a part they could only play because a collector wrote to Mark Twain long before his death and got a reply. Of course, one didn't have to be formally a collector to have saved such things, as this example shows. People who received letters from Mark Twain tended to keep them. This is a letter to the editor of Harper's Weekly, who has written to Mark Twain asking him for a short story. Mark Twain writes back and says, explains at some length, or another page actually, why he no longer writes short stories, can't get enough money out of them, take too long to do, etc. I know about this letter because someone who inherited it walked over to the Mark Twain papers. It was pasted into a book. She brought the book with her. She opened it up and she said, "Is this the Mark Twain letter?" "Yes, it is." And so she gave it to us. That's nice. It doesn't always happen that way. But there are lots of people out there who have their own Mark Twain letters. Some of them don't even know it yet. Autograph collectors in general may seem a little like small game to you, so let me assure you that there were also lifetime collectors who aimed rather higher than mere signatures. The best known of these is probably J.P. Morgan, who knew Mark Twain, and in the last decade of his life offered him, $2,500. $2,500 for two literary manuscripts, Life on the Mississippi and Pudd'nhead Wilson. Mark Twain was flattered, literally flattered, to be offered that. In general, he placed almost no dollar value on these literary manuscripts. He was prone to just forgetting about them. But there is his response transcribed for you as well. I should have said that those manuscripts are in the Morgan Library, which is where Mark Twain wanted them to be. I think there can be no question that the most notable and the boldest and the most spectacular successful of these lifetime collectors was a man named James Fraser Gluck, a graduate of Cornell. Applause. You'll see why in a second. Mr. Gluck was a lawyer in Buffalo, New York, where Mark Twain had lived and worked briefly in 1869-1771. Gluck had the strikingly original idea of collecting literary manuscripts of contemporary living American authors, something very rare if not unique at the time, since almost no one thought American literature could hold a candle to British literature, or ever would. Who reads an American book, you know? In any case, he wrote to Mark Twain in early November 1885 and explained that he was a curator for the library of the Young Men's Association in Buffalo, now the Buffalo Public Library, and that he was collecting literary manuscripts to be put on permanent display in the library as a way of fostering interest in the literary life. I can assure you, sir, that it would be highly appreciated in this city, where you have many readers, if it should seem to you proper to send to the superintendent of the library, Mr. J.N. Larned, or to myself, such manuscript or manuscripts, throwing a wide net, as you might wish to present to the library. They will be accorded a place of honor and preserved in perpetuo. If I were asking this for myself, I should expect to be refused, for the compliance with such a request would be merely the gratification of a desire for a selfish possession. But I ask it in behalf of a large and constantly growing public institution, where such manuscript will be seen daily by hundreds of people, and through the sight of which interest in literature and literary men will be increased and perpetuated. He goes on to say, and by the way, would you go next door to your neighbor, Charles Dudley Warner, and Harriet Beecher Stowe, and ask them if they would give me a manuscript? There's no end to Mr. Gluck's boldness. Mr. Gluck's letter was, of course, among those that Mark Twain preserved among his papers. And he also preserved elsewhere the reply that he sent on 11 November 1885, the day after he received Gluck's letter. He said in brief, I will comply as far as I can with the greatest pleasure, that is to the extent of 50% of a manuscript book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. I have hunted the house over, and that is all I can find. This is Gluck's letter, first page of it. This is the envelope of Gluck's letter, on which Mark Twain has written, sent what was left of Huck Finn. Sorry, hard to read. And here he's written, haven't a manuscript left. In other words, I'm out. Don't have any manuscripts to give. But he gives half of Huckleberry Finn. Why doesn't he give the whole of Huckleberry Finn? Because he can't find the first half. And he has a long explanation, which he gives to Gluck, that basically he thinks it went to the printer and was thrown away, whereas the second half was typed first, and therefore it was preserved. That turns out to be a mistake. Both halves were typed, as we now know. And both manuscripts, that is the handwritten manuscripts, stayed in his possession. We know that in part because 17 months later, Mark Twain finds the first half of the manuscript and sends it to his agent in Hartford, who sends it in turn to Buffalo. And they acknowledge receiving it in 1887, saying, thank you for sending us the first half of Huckleberry Finn. We already had the second half. Fair enough. Unfortunately, they didn't put the first half into the library. So for 105 years, nobody knew where the first half of the Huckleberry Finn manuscript was. In fact, it was assumed that it had been destroyed. Possibly the most important literary manuscript Mark Twain ever put his hand to. We don't know why it wasn't put into the library. Mr. Gluck held on to it for some reason. There's some possibility that he was unhappy with the way the Buffalo Library was treating these manuscripts he was getting for them. And he had an agreement with them, which was that they, if they didn't meet certain requirements, all of the manuscripts would go here, to Cornell. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. In any case, he died 10 years after the first half was sent. That's the first page of the first half. Can't show you all 650 pages of it. He died. All of the manuscripts which he had were packed up into trunks and put away. His daughter eventually gave them to her brother's sisters, her nieces, who lived in Los Angeles. And in 1990, they decided that after having these trunks for 20 years, they better go find out what was in them. And they went up into their attic, and they found in the top tray one of these trunks, 665 pages, handwritten manuscript, the first half of Huckleberry Finn. So I guess it's fair to say that collectors don't always behave just as we'd like them to, but they are still the first indispensable line of defense against a permanent loss of Mark Twain's letters or literary manuscripts. The 100th anniversary of Mark Twain's death, of course, reminds us that it's no longer possible to follow in Mr. Gluck's footsteps. We can't any longer write to Mark Twain and ask him for one of his manuscripts. Does that mean that there is nothing of Mark Twain's left to collect? Susan Jaffe Tain's superb collection on display for you here is, of course, living testimony that the answer to that question is an emphatic no. But before I dwell a little more closely on some examples from her collection, I want to paint a brief picture for you of what all this looks like from my perspective as an editor trying since at least 1980 to produce a comprehensive edition of everything that Mark Twain wrote, a kind of edition of record, in much the way the New York Times is or was the newspaper of record, a resource on which anyone may freely draw for the most complete picture we have of what Mark Twain wrote, either for publication, for himself, or in correspondence with the world. If completed in printed volumes, this would probably be at least 100 volumes. We're maybe a third of the way done. When I first took this job as general editor in 1980, we actually had only the very roughest idea how many letters Mark Twain wrote, let alone how many we had of those letters, either in the original or as copies. I don't think we could have given you even a reliable approximation then, but in retrospect, I put the number at about 6,000. Between the time we created the first item-level catalog for the letters in 1985 and now, the number has grown to something in excess of 11,000 letters. In 1985, we were finding in one way or another an average of about one letter a week, year in, year out. Today, we're finding still in one way or another an average of two letters a week. That is 100 new letters every year. How can that be? How can that be? He is dead, isn't he? We currently estimate that Mark Twain wrote at least 50,000 letters, of which we have so far only about a fifth. If he wrote one letter a day between his first extant letter in 1853 and his death in 1910, that would be 20,000 letters. So to make 50,000, you'd have to have written 2.5 letters every day. For the early years, that rate is almost certainly too high, but for the later years, it's not too high. We have good evidence that you could write easily, often 20, 30, even 40 letters a day, not counting telegrams. So whether or not our estimate is correct or even close doesn't much matter. It's about all we can do to accommodate the arrival of new letters, two of them every week. Where do they come from? Everywhere. Everywhere. People walk in off the street, as I said, and say, is this a Mark Twain letter? Back in 1987, I got a call from someone downstairs at the Bancroft's reception desk. There was a man there who said he had 100 letters by Mark Twain. Did I want to see them? I said, no, I already had enough letters. What he had were slightly more than 100 letters to Mark Twain's wife and children, documents that were clearly owned once by Clara Clemens Samosud. I asked him how he got these letters, which, just to give you an idea, were eventually sold at auction for about $500,000. He said he was a retired bank executive whose hobby was stamp collecting. He had recently bought the letters at a kind of informal speculative auction from his normal stamp dealer. Basically, he put them in a big plastic bag, and you look at them through the plastic bag and bid. He bid $200. And he explained to me that there weren't any good stamps in there. And that ordinarily, he would have simply thrown the letters away. But for some reason in this case, he didn't. He couldn't explain why. And then one day on a bus in Southern California, he sat next to a young lady to whom he turned and asked, "Who is S.L. Clemens?" Here's the amazing part. She knew. Why that question? Why that question? On just a few of the envelopes in the upper left corner was Mark Twain's standard printed return address. If not delivered in 10 days, please return to S.L. Clemens. The words Mark Twain appeared nowhere on these letters and envelopes. They were all addressed to his wife and his children, and of course signed Papa, or Sam, or La Guignille, or any of a dozen other nicknames that he used. It turned out that these letters had been sold to the people who bought Clara's Los Angeles home in 1951, put away in a shoebox along with their coin collection, and one supposes never looked at again. When the couple grew old and died, or grew too old to manage things, the lawyers were called in. This is an enormous house. They found the house filled from floor to ceiling with waste paper. They never threw anything away, newspapers, wrapping, you name it. So when this very sharp lawyer finally came across this shoebox of letters and envelopes, he had a very shrewd idea. He would sell them for the value of the stamps. I think you can see that the fact that we still have these letters, that we still can have access to them, is something of a miracle. Another story, Richard Monckton Milnes, 1st Baron Houghton, died in 1885. He knew Mark Twain. Mark Twain knew him. His papers were eventually given to the British Museum, which sometime almost 100 years later, that is 1985, got around to cataloging them. That's a pretty standard backlog. Some sharp-eyed curator, who never did provide her name to me, sent me Xeroxes of 14 letters by Mark Twain to Lord Houghton and several of his close associates. I returned the favor and sent her Xerox copies of the letters from Houghton to Mark Twain. But you can see that we would never have known about these things until the British Museum decided to catalog the papers. Another example. 5 years ago, the widow of the great grandson of Albert Bigelow Paine, Mark Twain's official biographer, a man named Bigelow Paine Cushman, sent us what amounted to 2,000 typed copies of Mark Twain letters. These are typed copies that had been prepared for Paine when he was working on the biography. He had carte blanche from Mark Twain. He could go to anyone who was a correspondent of Mark Twain and say, "Give me your letters." And he would take them home, type them up, and give the letters back. Usually give the letters back, not always. In this bunch of typescripts, I would say roughly 80% were letters whose originals we had already located. But that meant that for 200 letters, remember, this is one gift, 200 letters from Clemens and his wife, Olivia, we had no text whatsoever. Now, these typescripts are not as good as manuscripts, but they were actually fairly carefully typed, and they are very enlightening because the ones that were unknown to us are the ones that Paine didn't want to use. They're filled with things that Mark Twain said a little too sharply for Paine to include. They are quite accurate and complete, and so though not quite as good as the original manuscript, they are as good as we're probably ever going to get. I hear regularly, at least once a week, from Barb Schmidt and other Mark Twain researchers sending me the URL for online sales of Mark Twain letters that have hitherto escaped us. 6 weeks ago, we heard from someone in Texas who had two letters Mark Twain wrote to his typist, the man who typed the manuscript of Huckleberry Finn. I shouldn't stop to explain why that's of interest, so just take my word for it. It is of interest to us. I referred her to one of the most knowledgeable manuscript dealers in the world, who sent me scans of the letters in question. I want to stop telling these stories here so I have time to comment on some of the particular documents in Susan's collection. How's my time, folks? Am I out of time? A couple minutes. Okay, let's do this fast. This is a page from one of Susan's letters. The simple point is that we knew about this letter because it had been partly published in the Critic here. He starts, "Dear Gilder." And this is the letter that goes down, signed there. But you can see that they begin the letter here. In other words, all of this is left out because it's personal. Gilder's the editor of the Century, but he's related to the editor of the Critic, and that's why it goes into the Critic. So my point is simply that we could rely on this for the text of the letter, but it's like relying on a filtered, edited version of something that you might otherwise call reality. Here's what that transcribed looks like. You can see that the cancellations have been read, so we know what he crossed out. And you can see that this pencil note up here, which is not in Mark Twain's hand, says, "In an unknown hand, Mark Twain to R.W. Gilder, editor of the Century, while writing the following," that's not quite right. 96, he's not yet writing it, he's still in India. And what he's talking about is this collection of drawings, architectural drawings, that he thinks really the universities of the country ought to have. This is another letter, another page in the same letter, and you can see that this cancellation begins nowhere. That is to say, there's something missing from this thing. That's very typical of Mark Twain, to cancel something, take out the page, and leave this cancel hanging. And this is an explanation, again, not in the Critic at all, because it's personal. "Love to the boys. P.S. If I can get photos of the Maharaja, I'll enclose it. P.P.S. I enclose it." And you notice that he did. He got the Maharaja's picture. My point is just simply this, that without Susan's collection, we would have only a very limited grasp of what's in this letter. People ask me about reading the cancellations. Mark Twain loved cancellations. He liked to play with them. This is an example of his letter to Olivia when they're courting, and he realizes that she's trying to read his cancellations. So he writes this really in order to be canceled. Oh, I can't tell it again. You would say I was a lovesick idiot. And between ourselves, I am. I could not be so reckless as to write the above if you had any curiosity in your composition. That's a reference to what she's doing. And then this is supposed to be her when she discovers what he's just said. Oh, yeah. Well, we know that he thinks that they can be read because he invents a way that they can't be read. This loopy, loopy, loop thing is very typical. That's the way he does it. And he knows that when you begin to read it, what you do is to look for the ascenders and the descenders to start getting an idea of what consonants are being used in the word. How many words do you know that have three Fs in a row? What he's done here is to go and impose false ascenders and descenders, putting in Ts and crossing Ls and things like that. So, as he says to Livy, "That's the way to scratch it out, my precious little Solemnity, when you find you have written what you didn't mean to write. Kiss me, Livy, please." In other words, I dare you to read it. And of course, she couldn't. This is a letter to one of the Gillises. Susan has the only original letter of Mark Twain's to one of the Gillis brothers I've ever seen. Well, we've known them only as photocopy. And it took us about 8 months to read this cancellation, which I've transcribed for you here. If we had had the original, it would have taken a lot less. That's another reason that her collection and other people's collections are vital to us. She also has an example of a letter that she told me, in fact, she'd seen this with other authors, surprises us because it looks for all the world like a complete letter. I bought my Jumping Frog, so for the sign, Mark Twain, et cetera, et cetera. But I know, and through much labor, we figured out that it's not the complete letter. The complete letter actually isn't in any one place. It's in three places. This letter is here today. These two pages are at Yale. And these two pages are at the University of Virginia. And when you put them all together, you you can figure out that that's the letter. In fact, that's the fifth page of the letter. That's what this little mark up here is, Mark Twain's page number. Okay. This is very daring of me to put this in here. I just want to close with the fact that I've been working on this question of where things are, where Mark Twain things are, for a long time. That picture was taken in 1967. It was taken about the time I said to my boss, look, I see here in American Literary Manuscripts that there are 50 institutions that claim they have Mark Twain stuff. Let's write to them and ask them to give us copies. This is the letter I designed. In fact, it's the letter I sent to, what do you know, to Cornell. So actually, it's a carbon. In those days, you didn't have a computer, you had carbon. Those are my initials down there. I wrote it for the editor to sign. This is the editor. His name is Fred Anderson. In any case, when I proposed this, he said, oh, I'm sure we have everything. But he let me do it anyway. Type 50 letters. And that's how I looked before I typed. And then for the next 3 years, it rained Xerox. So my point is simply that I've been working on this a long time. It's not getting any better. Things are getting thicker. There are more of them. Our collection has a responsibility also to buy. It's just an example of something we recently bought. But also, I'm going to end with this example. Just say that you also have an obligation not just to collect things from out there, but to know what's in your own collection. This is the only book plate Mark Twain ever used. It's obviously not Mark Twain, it's Sam Clemens, because it's Dateline Hannibal. It has to be before 1853 when he left Hannibal. This was in the Mark Twain papers from the beginning at their creation. It was not discovered until 1984 because Jane Clemens, whose Bible we found it in, had filed it the way you file anything if you don't have file cabinets. She put them between the leaves of the big Bible. And no one had ever bothered to look through the Bible page by page to see what she'd put in there. This is certainly the earliest known document that Mark Twain or the Sam Clemens ever put his hand to. It doesn't solve the ending of Huckleberry Finn, but it is something you'd like to know about. I'd be happy to answer questions. Should we turn the lights up so you... No. Would you feel less synonymous if I did that? No, okay, all on. There. Then I can see your hands. Please don't disappoint me. I love questions. Yes.
What sort of difficulties are there in authenticating them?
It's a very good question. Well, the first line of difficulty is that most manuscript dealers will not ask you, is this real? They don't want to ask you because they're afraid of what you'll say. No. If they ask and you say no, then they cannot legitimately sell it as Mark Twain. So that's the first problem. There are forgeries out there. We know that. We keep track of them. Every time we locate one, we file it. So we keep, close tabs on it as we can. But I almost said, is that a trick question? Because how would you know if you'd accepted a forgery that you didn't detect? The fact is, forgeries are pretty good. We've seen some forgeries that would have fooled us. The handwriting looked so good, and the paper was so legit, and the ink looked pretty good. It would have fooled us, except that they put him in New Orleans when we knew he was in New York. Now, they made a simple factual error that tripped them up. So the real answer is I don't know how many forgeries I'm counting as among the 11,000 letters. But if you take people like my staff and then make them look at Mark Twain's handwriting for 40 years over and over again, they're pretty good at detecting forgeries. They're pretty good at detecting when it's not right. And back there, yes.
There was an article in the Times this week about Mark Twain's will. It estimated his estate at around $500,000 at that time, which I think they said was the equivalent of around $10 million at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's apparent that he saw himself as a business. What effort did he take to actually preserve these letters for his children? I mean, I guess Clara's benefit from the sale.
Mm-hmm. Haphazard is right. Well, of course, he hasn't much control over letters that go out into the world, but he had a vast cache of manuscripts, which is the Mark Twain papers. He writes his will in such a way that he's thinking that Jean and Clara will survive him, but actually only Clara does. They cannot transfer ownership in the papers except through their own will. In other words, they have to die in order to make the papers owned by somebody else. Okay, this is a way of protecting them from men. It didn't quite work, but it did keep the papers together. Okay? She couldn't sell them off piece by piece. She eventually married a second husband after Gabrilowitsch. She married a guy named Samosud, who was something of a snake. He was a gambler, and he basically drained her of about $5 million, losing it at the track. And he would periodically try to sell manuscripts that were still in the family. For instance, those 100 letters I was talking about, he clearly sold them to the people who bought the house for cash so he could bet. So I don't know if that answers your question exactly, but it comes as close as I can to saying what it is that Mark Twain did to protect the literary archive that he was leaving. Of course, he was also putting it in the hands of Paine and Clara, so he knew they would restrict access to it. I'm not sure he approved of that, but he knew they would do that. Yes?
I'm just wondering to what extent you're proactive in looking for personal documents, letters, photographs, and so on. I'm thinking in terms of Mark Twain's circle of friends at the time, and if you do archival genealogical research to trace
your descendants. Did I hear the question? What extent are we proactive in looking for these things? I have to say that we are as proactive as we can afford to be. Okay. After that survey back in 1967, we've repeated the survey to various libraries, extending it to historical societies and so forth and so on. It gets larger and larger every 10 years. And of course, these libraries do not remember to tell you when they get new letters. Okay. But I have to say that the real pursuit of all these things in a kind of dogged way is tied to the publication, let's say, of letters. If you're editing the letters for 1872 to 73, you do everything you can to take all of the leads that you've got and trace them back as far as you can. Now, the reason I say as much as we can afford is that the job of doing this could occupy a 10-member staff full time right now, especially now that we have electronic searching of newspapers. There's a recent biography of Mark Twain, which I highly recommend, The Man in White. Is that right? Michael Sheldon, not sure I got the title right. He took advantage of electronic newspapers and followed out leads that, you know, that we had never dreamed of following. But he was dealing with the years 1906, 1907, 1908, and 1909. We're not there yet. We've only published the letters up to 1880. When we get there, I hope we can do as good a job as he did. Does that answer your question? Yes, back there.
Letters from Libby, Jean, and Clara. Are you also seeking those?
We would, indeed. I mean, we were just as interested as we can be. For some reason, we don't understand this. The family was very good about preserving all of his letters. And we believe that they were good also about preserving Libby's letters. But they have largely disappeared. Certain big chunks of them show up every now and then. We have some suspicions about what happened in this 1951 sale when when Samosud and Clara sold off everything they had, including all of Mark Twain's library books, manuscripts, letters. We think that those Libby letters, went in that sale, but we can't prove it. So the record is much spottier for her, and I would say also for Clara and Jean. But yes, we do collect all those as well. We're not always able to publish them I've made a policy basically of putting all such letters in the annotation. That is, say, if you have a letter from Mark Twain that's to Livy or she's writing to him, hers goes into the notes in full, not just a quote. Unfortunately, the funding situation is such that I can't afford to do everything that I'd like to do. And that would be to publish all of those letters on an equal basis. Back there.
The fact that so many letters keep turning up means that the letterpress volumes you published are instantly out of date.
Instantly out of date.
Does that mean that you're going to shift to electronic publication that can be constantly updated? And
got a pencil? Got a pencil? MarkTwainProject.org. Go there and you'll see. We have finally put the investment into a website that can actually handle converted versions of our books and where we will publish now continuously, sometimes with books, but not always with books. For instance, this fall we'll publish the first volume of the autobiography there as well as in a book. But your point about there being out of date as soon as the new evidence comes up is quite relevant. The nice part about electronic publication is that you can go back and sift those letters in where they belong. What you can't do so easily is to adjust the annotation that was written without knowledge of those letters. And so you're in a bind because you have to kind of decide how much re-editing to do, how much re-editing will the funding agent allow you to do before it says, stop, no more. But the fact is, they can be made available in their chronological sequence. You can flag them so people can go look for the new letters, et cetera, et cetera. It's the best thing about electronic publication. Yes?
You speak of the first half of Huck Finn, the second half handwritten, and then the typewritten. Is it true that Huck Finn is the first American novel to be published, sent to the publisher in typewritten form?
Not the first, because Life on the Mississippi, 1883, precedes it. Yeah, Mark Twain is the first to have his manuscripts typed. And he's very clear about why. He says, in the past, I would have a handwritten copy made for security, but it always looked like somebody else's work, so I couldn't revise it. But if you type it and double space it, you can revise it extensively. And that's what we discovered that Mark Twain does. You know, he has the reputation of not revising his work because he doesn't do the way Henry James does. He doesn't take the first edition and the second edition and change it and change it and change it and wind up with two different books. No. Mark Twain never revises a book after it's published, but he revises extensively before it. So when you discover the manuscript of Huckleberry Finn, you are finally in a position to figure out how he changed it on that typescript, even though you can't see the typescript. It's lost. The typescript goes to the printer. The printer almost certainly throws it away. He might send it to Los Angeles, but I'm not sure. I mean, everything goes to Los Angeles eventually. But the point is, you can figure out there's the difference between the manuscript and the first edition. Who made the difference? That's basically what the editing of that text involves. And the result is you have just remarkable evidence about how he revised. I mean, there's a very famous chapter called Chapter 19, Huck's Description of the Sunrise on the Mississippi. And it's been hailed by all kinds of critics as the discovery of the style, blah, 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 blah. You can take that method I'm just talking about, and you can see that every value that they praise in that passage was achieved in revision by Mark Twain. So that's very exciting for us. It's really more important than getting a pure text. Come on, yeah, it's good.
Mm-hmm. How much more is there?
That's what I've been asking myself all these years, you see? That's what I was trying to tell you. This may sound odd, but I have very highly trained editors who know how to do that kind of thing I was just talking about. They know how to figure out what happened to the text of Huckleberry Finn. That's a very complicated process. And their services would be, in a way, wasted on taking unpublished manuscripts and transcribing them and publishing them basically the way I did. I did that really as an experiment. It's the first time we have ever published anything outside the University of California Press. I was trying to send the press a message. I wanted the autobiography to be properly published and widely distributed and to sell a lot of copies. So I went to a commercial publisher who was delighted to publish 24 pieces that no one had ever read before. To answer your question a little more straightforwardly, I would say there are at least another 75 short pieces, finished, unfinished, that we have not seen print. Right? We simply haven't concentrated on that since the beginning of the papers, where the largest of those manuscripts were published by the editors. The dark manuscripts, the 3,000 years among the microbes, the mysterious stranger manuscript, all those things deserved immediate attention. These are really less urgent, especially since anyone can see them. Now, I want to say that again. I always get asked, what do you have to do to get in to see the papers? Nothing. Show me a driver's license. Give me your wallet. I'll give it back to you without the money, but anybody can use them. And in fact, scholars have used all these things. No scholar would think of those pieces as unknown. He almost certainly read them in manuscript. I don't think so. Hal Holbrook's got a special gift, and we're all very lucky for it. I mean, we edit Mark Twain's texts, and we print them, but we can't perform them, and he does. Thank you very much.